The difference with a puppy mill is just by the nature of it. It is a farming company. And if you think of any crop, as sad as it is, you know, our four-legged friends are so not a crop in our worlds, but that is, it's just a commodity. It's just a product. And so they want to make as, you know, a farm wants to produce as many soybean bushels as possible. Well, these puppy mills want to make and produce as many puppies as possible because it's a numbers game. It's all about money.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Purple Stars podcast. My name is Sarah, and we're so honored to have an amazing guest back on the show. Her name is Dr. Rini Alsaroff. And if you haven't listened to our episode, she is a renowned veterinary oncologist, author, lecturer, speaker, and just above all, a person with a really kind heart. And I'm just so excited to have her back. And we'll have a very interesting topic today that we want for all of you to get a better insight. So please stay tuned. Welcome, Dr. Rini Alsaroff.
Oh my goodness, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Sarah.
Yeah, I was so excited when you agreed to coming back, because I know every time when we talk, you're like, oh, I'm Florida, I'm here, I'm there. You're always very, very busy doing good in the world. But we had Martina Pluto, who is head of HSI, Italy, and an animal rights advocate on last year, and she already talked a little bit about puppy mills and puppy laundering. And I know that in the US, it's also a big topic, but still a lot of people don't know enough about it. So I thought we're going to talk about it and dedicate an entire episode with all the information. So when people do get a new puppy for their family or a new dog in general, also if it's an older one, just to know the red and the green flags, so they're actually really doing something good. My first question, Renee, maybe for those who are not yet that familiar with the topic, what are puppy mills, and also how can people spot them?
So a puppy mill is actually a commercial farming company that breeds typically large numbers of purebred dogs, often in substandard or very poor conditions. And your second question was, how can you spot them? Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, most all of the dogs that are sold in pet stores come directly from a puppy mill. They might say that they were from a breeder, but truly, you know, reputable breeders do not send their dogs or their puppies to a pet store.
And how do people know what's the difference between a breeder and a puppy mill if they're visiting a site, for example?
Right. So a breeder, it's going to be like they're going to interview you as much as you're going to interview them. They're going to want to make sure that their puppies are going to good, loving homes, safe. They're going to get the right care. Now, that being said, a puppy mill could still turn it around and ask you those same questions. But a good breeder is going to be interested in promoting the best that they can do for their breed, right? That would be in terms of conformation, to make sure that their puppies are built, right, or bred in a healthy way. So, a good breeder will check if their dogs have, you know, hip dysplasia or congenital hereditary eye disease or Wobblers or Von Willebrands for Doberman Pinschers, things like that. A good breeder will not breed very often because it's not meant just to churn puppies out. It's meant to help promote healthy, good, you know, puppies and that breed. A good breeder will breed for temperament as well as physical health, right? So that you're getting a very sturdy, loving, not aggressive dog, not overly shy dog, things like that. And that's very, very important. The difference with a puppy mill is just by the nature of it. It is a farming company. And if you think of any crop, as sad as it is, you know, our four-legged friends are so not a crop in our worlds, but that is, it's just a commodity. It's just a product. And so they want to make as, a farm wants to produce as many soybean bushels as possible. Well, these puppy mills want to make and produce as many puppies as possible because it's a numbers game. It's all about money.
With puppy mills, how often do they usually breed, and what happens especially to the mothers? Because if they're used as machines, basically, like what are the health consequences?
Oh my goodness. So many health consequences. In terms of your first question, how often do they breed? They breed as quickly as they can. So once those puppies have been whelped, in other words, they're no longer suckling from the mom, and getting the milk, they're going to go right back to try to breed them. Now, certain breeds only have heats certain amount of, times. So they can only breed them so many times in a year. For some breeds, it might only be once every 8 to 12 months or so, but it's just a constant turnaround. As opposed to a breeder, she wouldn't do that, right? Because we all know it doesn't matter if you're an animal or a person, carrying a one child or a whole litter of puppies takes a lot out of your system. So for puppy mills, those dams or bitches, if you will, are depleted from their nutrients. Their skin often hangs. Their teats are very pendulous and hang. And quite frankly, once they sort of age out of breeding, they are of no use to them, right? So they would either get rid of them, one way, or they might try to sell that dog. And what I have learned, only because I adopted my female, is that it's harder to adopt a female dog that has had puppies because she has those pendulous teats or mammae. And people don't like that, right? They like that sleeker kind of look, which only made me want to adopt my dog even more.
How did you do your background check when you adopted your dog as a vet?
So I actually got her from a breeder, so
Okay.
she had been used for breeding. She had had two litters total, and her last litter ended in a dystocia, meaning a difficult pregnancy that required a C-section or a cesarean section. And because of that breeder said, "You know what? I'm not going to do that anymore." And that's how I got her. Dusty was 4.5 years of age at the time.
This is another sign what a big heart you have, because I think, regardless of the aesthetics, I anyway find it really heartbreaking if people pick their dogs and say, oh, I don't want this because it doesn't look as sleek or whatever. But I also think taking on a dog who has had like a lot of physical challenging times and bringing them on, it is a big heart because, I think as a vet, of course, you do have fortunately the education and also the information how to help the dog. But nevertheless, it is extra, it's extra time and love and care that the dog needs. And when being working full time, not everyone is able to do that. So I think it's very admirable.
Well, you're so sweet. Thank you. And Sarah, most of these dogs are not socialized, right? They're not living in a house. It's a business. It's a farm. So they might be living in a kennel or a cage. So they maybe have not seen grass before, or they haven't been around a family before. So they need a lot of work.
Where do people who are running puppy mills and puppy farms usually sell those dogs other than in what you already explained, like in the front store of like a pet place? Like, what are some red flags that I could be looking for, and also pay attention as a person that wants to get a new dog?
So, kind of two separate questions. So, what I've learned is that unfortunately, a lot of the puppy mills are run by the Amish, and they employ a person called an Englisher, so, a non-Amish person, to actually do the transport to the pet store. And that Englisher, if you will, is also responsible for any online computer type advertisement, communication, emails with a prospective, pet parent. And if that puppy does not pass their initial vet visit, then that pet store typically does not pay for that dog. And what tends to happen is the Englisher either takes it back to the farming community, in which case it might not be around, or if they have a relationship with a local shelter, they'll call that shelter and try to sell it to the shelter for like $300 is the typical fee. Things in terms of red flags to look for. Well, I think sadly, most any pet store, right? And it's so hard. It's just like, if I go into a candy store, even if I say I'm not going to eat, you buy any piece of candy, I'm coming out with a bag of candy. I'm not leaving without a candy. And you know, it's not the puppy's fault. They're darling and cuddly and they have puppy breath. And of course we want to adopt them and we want to help them. And maybe they're poor doers or, you know, we were told they were the runt and that's why the breeder got rid of them or some other type of thing. But really, they came most likely from a puppy mill. If you are told that it's from a certain breeder, researching that breeder up and down is very important because, again, you know, the internet is a great thing, but anyone can put anything on the internet. And really finding out about that puppy, that's a very important thing. Lastly, the only way to stop this, right, is for all of us to stop buying the puppies. Right? It's just a business to them. That's what's hard.
What are steps that we as individuals can do to stop it till no one buys those puppies anymore? Because I feel like it's a little bit like a one-way street. Because let's say one puppy mill farm has 800 dogs. If no one gets them, they're probably going to get rid of those 800 dogs in a way that's really cruel and horrific. So what would be something that we can do to, on the one hand, stop it, and at the other hand also, you know, like, not put those puppies that are already out there right now at health risk?
Correct. So I think as an individual, not so much, no offense. I think as a society, it would be great if breeders had to be licensed in order to breed dogs, right? And so then whatever government, if that's at the local level, the state level, you know, my dad would be a national thing, but at the, say, state level, they had stringent guidelines. They had, inspections if needed. They would probably need to know how many are being bred in a year's time, etc. I think that would greatly help. And then sadly, it's just not buying them, as hard as that is. There is something called puppy flipping, which is a new-ish phenomenon. And, you know, with COVID, everyone got to hunker down in place and everyone wanted a puppy and that was great. And so for the puppy mills, the business was wonderful. But now that we are sort of out of the worst of COVID, there are no moratoriums anymore on rent prices. So rent prices are going much higher. Places that used to have in place that you could have pets now says you can't, or they're going to charge more, so people can't afford it. So people are actually not buying puppies as readily as they were from puppy stores. And that's hard, right? Because again, it is just a business to the puppy mill.
When you talk about puppy flipping, are we talking about the puppy mills are flipping, or do we have someone else that's also profiting a lot of, when it comes to that?
It's probably the latter, right? It's probably the puppy mill's producing the puppy. It's kind of stuck, can't go anywhere. So then someone else, a middle person, comes in and takes it on as their own shelter or as something else, and then tries to flip it for an even bigger profit. Now, this is different from wonderful, wonderful shelters that do an immense amount of good, that educate the public, that help to heal the dogs and cats that are strays or that get abandoned. It is different than that. And some of those, because they have a good heart, because they have a relationship with the Englisher, right? They try to take some of those puppies. But we're not talking about that. That's not puppy flipping.
Renee, when someone would go to a shelter, what would be some red flags if they get a puppy that this shelter knowingly got that puppy in to make a lot of profit?
So, you know, most shelter, well, I shouldn't, a lot of shelters are city run, right? So it would be your town's, you know, animal shelter, et cetera. They have been established for decades. Everyone knows about them. You can ask your neighbor or your neighbor's neighbor about them, and you have that good rapport. They are not there to make a big profit. They are just there to do a service to or for society and for animal kind. They are there to provide immediately the correct vaccination history, the entire background, where they got the puppy or the adult, you know, what problems it has. They will be well vetted, and I don't just mean by a veterinarian, but they will know if they're good with children, if they're good with other dogs, if they're good with cats, if they would only be good in, you know, an older home, or if they're good with a lot of chaos. Because their whole goal is that pet's best interest. I know that they get frustrated when people say, oh my gosh, it's easier to adopt a child than it is a puppy from you or a dog from you. But it's because they don't want that dog to come back. It's just like, you know, every time it comes back, it's even harder to rehabilitate that dog.
What are about, because I'm sure like some are locally or state organized. Nevertheless, there are a lot of privately run foundations. How do I know if I'm going to one of those privately organized foundations that it's let's call it mission over matrix and not matrix over mission?
That's a great term. I think it would be hard. I really do. Mm. I think part of it is the feeling. I think part of it is going in person. Anything that you are getting online, where you are getting that puppy shipped to you or on an airplane, or will meet you at the exit, you know, exit number 5 at the gas station, none of those are green flags. Those are all yellow, if not red flags. Not getting that full history. You know, most of those shelters should still be nonprofit and should still do it with a very altruistic approach. You know, paying thousands of dollars for a little stray puppy is a lot.
Is a red flag. Mm-hmm. I know in California, puppy mills are banned, but nevertheless, in the Midwest, there are lots of states where it's still allowed. And Missouri is the number one puppy mill state. Would you say if a shelter says, oh, we got all these puppies from Missouri, that could be a potential red flag?
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. You know, I think what's hard to, and it goes back to your question about what can we do, right, to stop all of this. We're in an age where we don't want to wait. And Amazon has reinforced that. We click a button and 24 hours later, it is on our doorstep. And that sounds fantastic. But if you remember the original way we all had to get a dog is unless it was truly from a shelter and it was a stray and needed perhaps, a lot of caring, if you got a dog or a puppy from the breeder, you had to wait, right? And you might even have to be on a waiting list just until that female dog gave birth to her litter. And I think that's really reality. And because we now all just want it when we want it, which I totally get, right? When I was ready for a new addition, I didn't want to wait either, but I know that good things come to those who wait, and they're often healthier and bred better. So it's where patience makes a difference.
And I love how you said, those who wait get rewarded, because I also believe when we get a new pet, it's a commitment and a decision to have a love relationship for many, many, many years, touch wood, many years. And that's why I also want to throw in a red flag would be if a rescue says you gotta pay and decide whether you want the dog before actually even having the chance to see the dog one-on-one live, because
Right.
like it's not an
Right.
online shopping like Amazon.
Yeah.
It's actually getting a new family member, building a new relationship. And as adorable all of the dogs are and all of them need a home, when picking a dog or a cat, there needs to be this heart-to-heart connection when you see them that you're like, okay, this is my dog. And yeah, like he or she made it all the way and waited for me. So I do think it's important to stay patient, to know the animal, whether it's from a breeder or a rescue or however the dog comes to you, will find you. But also,
Yes.
really, not to let anyone pressure you and say, oh, you got to pick up the dog tonight if you want him or her. But actually taking the time and saying, no, like I am really considering this dog and he or she's very adorable, but I wanna have the time to sit with him or her and just see how it feels for both of us, not just for the human being, but also for the dog.
Totally. Vic, everything you said. Run screaming as fast as you can away, sadly, right? No shelter. Doesn't matter if it's privately or publicly managed, would ever pressure someone. You should always see that pet. You should see a few animals or many animals because you need that bond. It's more than just one human plus one puppy or kitten or what have you. It's a special connection, and it might be the way they look at you or paw at you or just a feeling, but that is vital to your best friend for the next 10 years.
And you talked earlier about the proper vaccinations and medical history. I know there is a common misconception when people go to shelters to rescue a dog, you don't really expect much in return. It's not like going to a breeder where you can talk about the grandparents and get all the paperwork. But it is a misconception because actually, when you do adopt a dog, there's still a high chance, especially if they were rescued from a breeder, that you actually get the entire hard copy history of vaccinations and whatever it is. What are some of the experiences as a vet have you, like with patients coming in with their dogs and their cats, when it came to paperwork or not having paperwork?
Right. So when it comes from a puppy mill, it is truly black or white when it comes to being vaccinated. Some are never vaccinated whatsoever because that's some money. But others are terribly over-vaccinated and they're vaccinated starting at a much younger age. And again, it is no different than the herbicides and pesticides that some companies put on crops, right? or that the antibiotics that they give to some cows, you know, versus you want obviously food that's hormone-free and antibiotic-free, but they do it because a lot of times it's cheaper to give that dog numerous vaccines than to have that dog get sick, need vet bills, not do well, or heaven forbid, die from, you know, whatever sickness. So some places will over-vaccinate, others will under-vaccinate. A lot of breeders, though, like if someone was going to have to give up their dog, and it might be a sad, you know, topic, or, you know, the pet parent became geriatric and, you know, has to go into like assisted living and can no longer care for their pet. So sometimes they do go to shelters. Other times, if you are still in communication with the breeder, a breeder wants that sort of right of first refusal. You know, they want to take their dog back because they want to make sure it ends up in the best conditions possible. And you know what? We are talking about puppy mills and we're talking about breeders. There are just some regular people for just the kindness in their heart decide that they want to experience having their dog have a litter of puppies. And that is very different than a puppy mill as well. You know, it's not done with the same intent as a professional breeder, but that is not necessarily a negative thing. It's not really the best for the breed standard, but it's not the same as a puppy mill.
I'm not 100% familiar with those distinctions. Are these then called backyard breeders?
Yes.
What are risks of getting a dog from a backyard breeder since they are not experienced in the entire process? Because I can imagine some people do it because it's cheaper, it's quicker, it's maybe one of the neighbors, and it seems more convenient. But what could be some of the health risks that come both for the dog mom, but also then the puppy that they will get?
So sometimes it's a by accident, right? They didn't spay their dog and their dog got out and oops, it happened. So sometimes that's the reason. Other times some people might say, oh, my golden retriever is so nice. I'd love to have one of her puppies, right? So usually in those instances, not always, unfortunately, but usually in those instances, those families have a relationship with their veterinarian so that that dog is still getting very good veterinary care. And those puppies, when they're first born, are still getting very good veterinary care. What you risk, which isn't so much of a risk, is in terms of the conformation, it might not be the most, the best looking golden retriever or Bernese Mountain Dog or what have you, right? A good professional breeder will also, as we've talked about, breed for a good personality. So there's always going to be a risk for that as well. It's just not as large. A backyard breeder, you know, maybe won't test for genetically passed down traits, hip dysplasia, they should be OFA tested, right? Certain eye conditions, certain cardiac or heart conditions, certain blood conditions. So a good breeder will always have their dogs tested for all of those things, whereas a backyard breeder may not even have any idea or any clue about that.
So people have lots of options where and how they can get their new family member. I just want to quickly summarize, either from a traditional breeder. Obviously, it's up to everyone how they decide to get their family member, but I think whatever route they're going for, it's very important to do research, to talk to the place where they are getting the pet, and also what you said. It's a mutual, like it's not a one-way conversation, but it's like if it's a really good shelter or if it's a really good breeder, they will want to know where is the dog going, where is the kitten going, is that person You know, like, does he or she have the time to take care of them? And how, what's the home like? What's the family situation like? So just to be cautious. And also one of the red flags that we mentioned is the Midwest countries, if they say states, I mean, if they're coming from there, or also the cost, especially when coming from, like, getting the dog from a rescue. It shouldn't be $1,000, $2,000, or $3,000. Should always keep in mind it's a foundation and it's for a good cause, and that fee should be there to cover the transport costs, the food, the kennel, the vet cost, or whatever else needs to be covered, but not to make a big amount of profit.
Exactly. And you know, I know, Sarah, that you and I are of the same thought process. Like, there are such wonderful dogs that are in shelters that need to be adopted. You know, I don't think that everyone should or needs to get a dog, you know, a purebred dog from a breeder. There are so many loving furry friends, but you just have to be smart about it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And also I think wherever we get a dog, it's important that we are doing it then for a good cause if we go for the rescue, and that we're not like behind the scenes supporting a, you know, puppy flipping business, because then we're actually not doing anything good. And we are also putting the lives of many pets at risk as well. And this actually brings me to some of my other questions. So now when someone has a new pet at home, wherever the pet came from, what are some tips as a vet that people can look out for when it comes to helping the dog or the kitten to feel safe in their new home, you know, like to really relocate? And also when it comes to socializing and all the long list that we can do.
So it depends on the age of the pet, right? And it depends on the personality. I think the most important thing is education. Study up before you get your dog, even when you just get your dog, about, let's just say, the breed, or even if it is a mixed breed, you know, a lot of times either you or the shelter or your veterinarian can say, yes, you know, it looks like Labrador and Shepherd or whatever. Study up on those qualities, because they, dogs have such a small genetic pool that, and they're very specific, right? Like, I have boxers and they are very much alike in a certain way. So know about their exercise requirements, their dietary needs, their socialization needs. Some dogs, you know, really need, in addition to a loving home, just like a boss, right? Instead of, say, my boxer ruling my roost, they need to know that I'm alpha. And, you know, they need to listen, whereas opposed to maybe like a little teacup poodle or a shih tzu or something, darling, they're just so cute. They're not there to you know, rule the world. They just want to be adored for what they are. But it's really important. I think a tired dog is a good dog, right? So it's important to give your dog that physical exercise. But again, different breeds need different types of exercise. And it's also important mentally for them to be stimulated, even if it is that is just sniffing a lot of different smells when they go on a walk. For some dogs that are really high energy and really intelligent, they might want interactive toys where they have to, you know, solve a little puzzle to get the treat. Again, the little shih tzu, he's just happy to be on the sofa and look darling. She doesn't want to work for her treats, but that's okay. All of that is really important, and tremendous consistency. If you don't want your dog as an adult to be on the furniture, don't let it up some of the time on the furniture, because they won't understand. Or if you tell your dog, don't get up on the furniture, but they keep trying, and then the dog eventually wins out after the third time that it gets, you know, that it tries, all you're really teaching it is that it just has to keep trying, because eventually you're going to give in. And I don't think there's anything wrong if a dog's on your sofa, but it's just remembering to be consistent.
I love many things that you pointed out. One of the things, especially, is taking like researching on the breed and researching about all, its characteristics and its needs. I had Jasmine Kuhn on, and she talked about her dog, and her dog is a rescue dog and has like all guard dogs that you can potentially even have in one dog, all like together in one. And their dog trainer said something really interesting and said, you can train your dog, but you cannot train the breed out of your dog. So I do think it's important to honor and also to nourish the dog's nature and to know there is a part nature and a part nurture, but we shouldn't neglect the nature part. And I find it also really important that you mentioned the mental stimulation because although it's for you and me so obvious, there are so many people out there where they're now, okay, my dog needs food and water, some cuddles and walks, but they completely forget about the mental stimulation. And I find it so interesting how it's not yet that common for people to see it as, oh yeah, my dog needs everyday mental stimulation. Fortunately, I think that's a good thing about social media, that a lot of accounts are there who give all sorts of great little reels, what you can do also with your dog at home to mentally stimulate them. And similar to what you said about accordingly to the breed, because every dog is very sweet, but some dogs are smarter and some dogs are less smart. And you gotta pick the mental stimulation accordingly to their level of smartness.
Exactly. Correct.
So I found that very, very interesting. And I also love what you said about consistency and setting boundaries. And I know it can be so hard when you have a new dog and they look at you with those big eyes and they're, like, just please give me the treat. Please let me be on the couch and please this. But I think it's very important to have a consistent mindset throughout the entire family. So let's say it's a family dog that every single one is on the same page. Whether the dog is allowed on the sofa or not, but not like having this inconsistency because it confuses the dog and also it frustrates then the people for, but it actually is our fault in that case. So I think it's very important to have that consistency. Now that we've covered the consistency and the boundaries and the mental stimulation and everything, what are some tips when it comes to building the bond with your pet?
Oh, that's such a sweet question. First of all, it'll just happen, right? They will worm their way into your heart and into your life. I think what is important is to make sure before you get that puppy, or maybe you're going to adopt an adult, to make sure you're ready. Because if you've lost your dog, and everyone has a totally different timetable, there is no wrong answer. There are people that want to go out that next week and get another dog. There are other people that need to feel all their feelings and mourn for months, sometimes a year on end. I am someone who needs to feel all my feelings and go through all of that. But you have to be ready to open up your heart. When we got, this was a couple of dogs ago, my son was still young, and we went to go pick up the puppy, and he was holding the puppy in the back seat, and I was driving my station wagon, and I thought I was a great mom, and I noticed in the rearview mirror that he was crying, and they weren't happy tears. And I'm like, sweetheart, what's wrong? And he felt that he was not being loyal to our previous dog. I know. And what I tried to explain is that our previous dog would want him to give his love to a new puppy and to play. They would play basketball together and all these wonderful things. But he had that guilt, and he did nothing wrong, right? Right? Guilt is a horrible thing, telling us that we did something wrong, but he didn't do anything wrong. But sometimes when you first get that puppy or adult dog, you compare them to your previous one. They're never going to be that same one. No matter how hard you try, it'll be the same conditions. It's just like if you have more than one child and you raise them the same way, they can be vastly different. And that's also okay, right? They're all here to teach us something, which kind of gets to my book, not meaning to, but they all have their own personality and lessons to impart.
Thank you so much for sharing that story about your kids, because I actually think it's something that a lot of us experience, that we feel that guilt, whether it's guilt to have a new dog or whether it's the guilt to be happy the first time after a pet passed away, or even like just loving another pet again. Like, there's so many reasons why guilt comes up. So I find it great that you shared this for people to know it is very human. And for many of us, it is part of the grieving process. And I also think moving through that stage of guilt brings another layer of healing as well.
I totally agree.
And what I would also really like to know before we then dive into all the wisdom you shared in your book is, when I read up about getting a new dog, I found so many articles about puppy blues. And I read in an article that in a UK, in a British article, that 37% of all dog parents have experienced some form of puppy blues. And I find that very interesting because I think a lot of us think when we get a new dog, whether it's a puppy or an adult, we should be happy all the time and find it exciting and taking the pictures and just like getting out of bed and like taking them out and being, grateful. But not that many people talk about the challenges that come with it when you potty train the dog and the dog gets up 4 times at night and you have a full-time job. So could we Have you ever experienced puppy blues, or do you know anyone who has experienced it?
So, first of all, any new addition, puppy, young adult, adult dog, is hard, right? There's going to be that re-entry process, and it's hard, and we forget because maybe we just lost our older dog and they were well trained and they were housebroken and they were just a delight. And now we're bringing someone home, say it's a puppy, who is 100% dependent on us and totally needy and doesn't understand our language and doesn't understand that it's not good to go to the bathroom in the house. I am leery with the term puppy blues. I like it and I don't like it, right? I like it because it does put a name on something that's very real. The part that personally I just don't like is when then that's compared to the baby blues for a woman who has postpartum depression, because it is vastly different. That is a true, for a woman that has postpartum depression, that is a true hormonal issue that is very real and can be very devastating and very severe. I think the puppy blues are real. I think some of it, not to discount it at all. So please don't take the order as any indication. Some of it though is like, oh my God, what have I done? Right? Like my previous dog was so much easier. Or your sleep is disrupted. So you're not thinking straight, you're not, your emotions aren't good. That is very stressful. Or you wanted the dog, but your partner not so much. So now it's also creating tension, and now you're frustrated with the puppy because she piddled on the floor again, because of course she did, right? Like, her bladder is really small and it takes a lot of time. And again, it takes a lot of consistency, but it's causing strife in your home. All of that is hard. That's where that education about that breed comes into play. I think it is paramount to talk to others, either join a puppy socialization class, which is doubly good. It socializes your puppy and it socializes you with other people who are going through it, so you can talk through those emotions. I think likely Puppy Blues also has what some of my son went through, those very real emotions where you're not sure if you're doing a disservice to the memory of your previous pet. And I think it's also important to remember that those blues, thankfully, are just temporary.
Yeah.
It could be weeks, it could be 3 months, but in general, they're temporary.
It's a really good point to point out when we are experiencing those blues, in whatever form it is temporary and it will pass. And I think any one of us who experienced lack of sleep or any change in their environment, even if it's for the better, it is dysregulating in the beginning. Like, we still got to rearrange our life till everyone finds their space within the family. And the dog feels the same. And it's for us and for the kids and everyone, and just knowing things take time, and also not having this timeline. Oh, now it needs to be like, it needs to be done in a week, or it needs to be done in 10 days. And I think the timeline in general is really good to, I mean, obviously, if there are vaccinations and things like that, you got to have a timeline. But I think for everything else, it's very important also to tune in with one's intuition a bit more, rather than going with the timeline. Oh, my neighbor's dog at 12 weeks could already do all these tricks and could do that and could this and that. My dog will live for a long time. So if he can do down 2 weeks earlier or 2 weeks later, it doesn't really matter. Most important is that we are building a relationship, and that everyone like finds their place and everyone feels safe and enjoys, you know, the company together. Because, yeah, as I said, down and sit and everything a little earlier, a little later, doesn't really matter.
It's just like when your child is potty trained, whether it's at whatever age or 3.5 to 4, they're still likely going to go to college, right? Yeah. Right on time. Like, it's not an indication of even you as a mom or as a pet parent. And and to your point about changing your life and stuff, I think that there's value, and it's, and you should, if you need to, mourn some of what you're losing, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of, well, usually after work, I go straight to the gym, but I had to give that up because I have to go and let out the puppy, and I need to now go exercise the puppy. And it won't be maybe a forever thing. But there is a loss of a person's, you know, usual routine, but the payoffs are worth it. That's the thing.
I love that you're pointing that out, because same as with the guilt, I think it's very human, even if we have this amazing plus now in our family, whether it's actually a human baby or a puppy or an older dog, that sometimes changes can feel like sacrifices, and a lifestyle change can feel like a sacrifice. But also, just because it feels like a sacrifice doesn't mean that we love the dog or the baby any less. I think it's also important to not feel guilty for that feeling, and knowing that it's very human. Yes. Renee, I also would really like to talk about your book once more. You already shared last time an amazing story about Daisy, and I loved it so much. And so for those who haven't listened to that episode, you wrote a book that's called Sit, Stay, and Heal, heal like healing. And You shared so many real life stories. I want to point out real life stories from your patients and their furry animals who are facing or who faced cancer and all the amazing life lessons that we can learn from them. And before we dive into one of those stories, I would love to know, what advice do you have for people so they can be more open and also more attentive to the wisdom that animals impart on us?
As a joke, read my book. That'll show you. I think, actually, aside from that, taking a step back, right? And just being present and living in the moment with their dog. I believe that dogs, and on a lot of levels, you could substitute any animal in that. And I think it's even the resounding theme in the book, is that dogs are not just wonderful companions for us, but they're incredible guides for when we struggle. And we all struggle at times. I firmly believe that they mirror for us how to live better, how to live happier. And we're really, really fortunate to have them in our lives. You know, they genetically, emotionally evolve to be a part of our pack.
I love what you said about not just a companion, but also guides. And I am such a big believer, and that's why this entire podcast exists, that when we are willing and when we open our hearts and our minds, that we can learn so much from animals. So, so, so much, because they are natural at being present, at forgiving, at loving, at maybe not so much at being patient. but, you know, it's just also resting. And they're just so natural at so, so, so many things. And I think if we, as you said, take a step back and if we're present, we can learn so much from them, about our relationship and also about ourselves. And I love that you mentioned the word mirroring, because I know you mentioned it in the relation of they mirror how we can live life to the fullest and live better lives. I actually also think they mirror our inner world. Like, I think our animals are just, in most cases, are showing us where our baggage is and our fears, and also where we still have a lot of potential if we, you know, face those fears and tap into it. And so that's why I just think if we are very present and spend time with them, and also feel, how does it make us feel if the dog pees against inside the house? Or, you know, like any of these little things, I think it just teaches us so, so, so much.
I firmly agree. I believe that our dogs, you know, our individual dogs are put in our lives at just the right time, you know. Sometimes when we didn't even realize we needed to learn something new, or perhaps there was some hole in me that needed to be helped or something. And while we'd all love our dogs to live so much longer, right, have a much longer natural lifespan, I know I've been blessed to have a few dogs in my life, and of course many of my patients, that have all taught me things along the way.
And one of them is Bentley and Dr. Bean. I reread your book last week when I was up in the mountains, and I thought a lot about their story because it's just so incredible, because both of them were battling cancer. And one of the many moments that I loved is how you asked the dog owner if you could hug him. I really got goosebumps in this moment, because the person was just very, I don't know if cold is the right way to describe, but just, you know, like just very emotionally neutral.
Yeah.
And I was just having that picture. I thought, wow, Renee really is warming his heart in with all of her superpowers of love. So could you share some of that story? Because I think it, like, our listeners will love it, and it will also warm everyone's heart.
Oh my goodness. So, okay. He was a gentleman who came initially to see me. His dog had cancer in the prostate. And, I always feel that knowledge is power, and it's my job to tell him all about the disease and the different things we can do and, what the prognosis would be. And he just basically stared right through me, foot tapping, arms crossed, wasn't going to have any of it. And I thought, well, he's probably not going to want to treat, but the very first thing that he asked when I walked into that room is, who's going to die first, me or him? And I didn't know him yet. I thought he was just being flippant, if you will, and how could I answer that question? So I just proceeded with, the typical spiel and the biologic behavior and all that stuff. And I thought he would just walk right out and be done, but he wanted and he chose to treat. And each time he came in, I think a little bit of that hard shell sort of melted or softened. And initially, I had judged him as just this crabby person. And instead of being crabby, he had so many things that he was dealing with, and he had terminal colon cancer. And partway through the treatment, he's like, Doc, not in a happy way, asked, who's gonna die first, me or him? And the initial title of that chapter was called A Race You Don't Want to Win, right? You don't want to win that race. And HarperCollins, which they're fantastic, suggested that each chapter was named after the pet, the true story that, it came from. But what was interesting is numerous lessons from every chapter, all different from each other. But Bentley, the very overweight beagle whose belly practically touched the ground as he walked, he met his pet dad where he was at, right? He didn't judge. If it wasn't a good day for his dad, he just stayed by his side, or I soon learned laid, next to him in bed if he had just gone through a really rough chemotherapy treatment. Or when the gentleman was feeling well, Bentley was eager and wanted to enjoy the day, whether that be with a walk or errands or what have you. So he met him where he was at. He never judged him. And yet I judged that gentleman until I got to know him better. And I came to not only look forward to, but cherish our conversations each time he came in. I only wish there could have been more. While we were supposed to see Bentley a few months after he was finished, just for a checkup, we never did see them back. And that's hard because I never knew what really happened at the end of that story. I later did look online, and I know that the gentleman had passed away probably about a year or so after we were done with the chemotherapy. So I never learned the answer to that. But what was so apparent and why he had that tough outer shell was he was grappling with his own mortality and potentially having to grieve the loss of his dog before him, or maybe he himself would pass away first, and then he would be leaving along his best friend. So there was a lot.
It's such a heartwarming story, and despite all the challenges and circumstances, I also think it's so beautiful. Because what you said, the dog met him wherever he was, at whatever state he was, when when Dr. Bean was in a good place that day. He would also want to enjoy, go for a walk, but he would also be very considerate if he wasn't in a good place. And it's such a beautiful gift that animals give to us, that they are adjusting and adapting out of care, out of love, for so, so, so many reasons. And what I also really loved about the chapter, what you also explained, is very often we don't know the backstory, and we don't know why someone is however they are, whatever, you know. And it's important to try as much as we can, and I know it's human to judge and to put labels on it, but to always think that person has a story that shaped them. And as long as we don't know the story, we need to keep the canvas blank and let them, so we also meet them where they are at.
Exactly. Correct. And I think Bentley the Beagle, you know, taught us about, or showed us about, mindfulness, right? Living in that moment, enjoying each day, not worrying about how many more days do I have, and wasting that time.
I read somewhere a quote that says in Buddhism, they think the highest form of spirituality and also being present is being an animal. And I found that so accurate, because they truly live in the moment. 100%. They really, really live in the moment. And of course, they have some trauma that do sometimes, you know, like affects their fears or their interactions, but overall they're so forgiving and they're so loving. And and they always pretend they haven't eaten all day because they forgot 5 minutes ago they got their meal. So it's really, really beautiful. And I'm wondering, what's your dog currently teaching you?
Oh my goodness. All right. So I have done so many things, like, I don't even know, probably 140 some interviews and TV and podcasts. No one has ever asked me that. What is my dog teaching me? You know, she is teaching me the power of positive female energy. I've had dogs my entire life. She is my only female dog I've ever had. And she is my girlfriend. And it's been wonderful.
What is your new definition now of female energy, or how was your perspective on it before you got your dog?
We're gonna stop for a second. She's bugging me, so hang on. Go. I'd like to, you know, she's like all over me. All right. Give me like, stop, seriously. It's, oh, you know why? It's dinner time.
Oh, okay. We'll make it quick.
5:30. She's like on me like Velcro and like whining. I'm so glad I'm wearing these earbuds so you can't hear that.
Okay. We'll make it quick.
Yeah. Okay. Wait, the question was, what is my new definition of female?
Or how, if it has evolved?
I think that's a hard question. I think part of that is just feeling good in your own skin, right? Mm. I adopted her when she was 4 and a half. Sadly, a boxer's lifespan, you know, isn't overly long. And she was already a little gray around the muzzle and had wrinkles and drool and had to be spayed because she just had her, you know, the harsh delivery. And yet everyone loved her. It didn't matter that she had those things. And I identified with that, right? My age, little wrinkles, maybe some gray hair. But to love myself just the same. And to have that power of, I don't know, taking care of myself, being good to myself. That doesn't always come so easily, right? My self-worth comes from checking things off my to-do list, not from other things. And yet it should be the other things that my self-worth comes from deep inside, not my itemized, you know, list of chores or things that I'm trying to accomplish. So I think that's what it is.
That's such a powerful lesson. I actually wish you would have included that in the book. I know that your dog is healthy, but like as a extra bonus, because right. It's such a universal life lesson, whether it's for a man or a woman, because life changes once we start accepting who we are and start celebrating who we are and feeling comfortable within our own skin, and that we detach our self-worth from the ticks of our to-do list. It's such a life-changing transformation. So that's why I'm very grateful you shared this on the podcast. And to make sure that your dog doesn't stay hungry because of the Purple Stars podcast, I am going to wrap it up now. Renee, thank you so, 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 so much for coming back on the podcast, because I think puppy mills and everything that comes with it is something that needs more attention and also more caution and information. And that's why I'm very grateful that we had you as an expert on, and I'm sure it will help many people out there. And I'm also always so grateful for your vulnerability and sharing and letting us meet you where you're at. So thank you so much.
Oh my gosh. Thank you too, Sarah. Take care.
Thank you. It's a wrap for today, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. And please make sure you share this episode with everyone who needs this information. And let us know your thoughts on this episode. And don't forget also to follow Renee and get her book. I'm going to put everything in the show notes, because you will love, 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 love every page of it. And we see you next Wednesday.